Today we continue with our Faith and Films series with reflection on the Pixar movie Monsters, Inc. In case you haven't seen the film, I'll describe just a bit of the movie, and for this movie in particular, it's best as you hear the plot, especially if you're hearing it for the first time, to just give in to the imagination of it all. So take a moment and tap into the childlike wonder within, because Monsters, Inc. is the power company in the land of monsters. Legitimate, hiding-in-your-bedroom-closet monsters. The company uses thousands of portal doors, which are available on a mammoth conveyor belt system, to bring monsters into each bedroom of children around the world. Two monsters work each door as a team, one to scare the child into screaming, and another to capture the energy produced by the scream. Scream, as it is called in the movie, is the renewable energy for the city grid. It is a scream energy initiative, a carbon and compassion-free power system. Monsters train in simulators before they can ever work on the factory floor. And it is in this scare training that monsters learn the touch of a child will kill them. So monsters train to get in, cause a scare, and get out quickly before that child can jump up, and of course, before parents come in or lights are turned on. On the factory floor of Monsters, Inc., the number one scream catcher team of James P. Sullivan, who is a big blue furry monster with large teeth, and Mike Wazowski, who is basically a small single green eyeball with arms and legs, they operate as a dynamic duo who seem to fear nothing at all except the deadly touch of children. So when little toddler Boo escapes into the monster's world through her closet door on the factory floor, all terror breaks loose in the land of monsters. Boo's presence in their land is considered an existential threat. Her very presence there has the power to kill. She is a foreigner in a foreign land. Helicopters go searching for the child to eliminate the threat. Monsters don hazmat suits in case of contamination. Monsters throughout the city and across the factory floor are questioned. Search parties go out, looking anywhere they think Boo might be located. Meanwhile, monsters Sully and Mike hide the child in Sully's apartment. Because of the child's delight in scaring the monsters by playing peekaboo and threatening to touch them, Sully calls the child Boo. Boo's giggles cause power surges, making it even harder to hide the fact that they are harboring a dangerous foreigner. Mike and Sully then, panicking, try to sneak her back into Monsters, Inc. in order to get her home before anyone discovers their involvement. Who knows how much trouble they would be in if anyone found them harboring a child who could kill monsters with a single touch. Now, with this plot line in mind, let us listen now for the word of God. Through Mark chapter 4, verses 35 to 41. On that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great gale arose and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already being swamped, but he was in the stern asleep on the cushion. And they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased and there was a dead calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "Who is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. When you hear this text, what kinds of questions pop into your mind? What do you wonder about in this very familiar scene? Sometimes we can learn as much from our questions as we can from immediate answers. Do you wonder about how tired Jesus must have been to be physically able to sleep in choppy waters like that during a great storm? How does he stay in one place on his cushion if the water is sloshing this way and that way, crashing over the side? How did he not roll right off his little stoop, plopping and sloshing around the boat? It seems like with nearly anyone else napping in that situation, gravity and the force of the waves would do the waking, not the disciples. Or maybe you wonder about the disciples. Why couldn't they just calm down a little? Maybe Jesus, in his wisdom, recognized that the storm was going to get worse before it got better. And so why not take a nap and get some rest before the hardest part comes along? What difference might it have made in the disciples' reactions if they had taken a power snooze on the boat with Jesus, 20 minutes of what my family calls an eyelid examination? Can change the way you see the world when you open your eyes again. Perhaps exhaustion shifted their perspective until anger, frustration, or despair were the go-to emotions in the midst of unsettled waters. Or maybe you wonder about what's happening to all of the people in the other boats surrounding the disciples mentioned in the passage. What happened to the people in those boats who did not have Jesus to turn to? Can you imagine being in the middle of a raging storm on a boat, followed by complete, immediate, utter stillness with no explanation? The disciples at least got to witness Jesus speaking into the chaos. What about everybody else nearby? Some of you may right now be thinking, there were other boats present? I totally missed that part of the text. Notice that. I encourage each one of us to think about the kinds of curiosities that we have when we hear this familiar text, because our questions can say a whole lot about our relationship with fear. Does fear in this situation seem to us obvious, normal, natural? And Jesus is the one who seems a little disconnected from a typical human reaction in the midst of a harrowing storm. Sometimes fear can keep us safe, right? Or does the disciples' fear seem to you like it could have been managed a little better? Do you find yourself wanting to teach them how to compartmentalize their emotional responses so they can work together to deal with the situation, systematizing bailing out the water, taking turns resting, something else? Does fear in this situation seem to you to be something to be managed or handled with a coping strategy? Or does fear here remind you of the sort of fear that simply overwhelms human beings in the midst of natural disasters and your caretaking tendencies kick in? Why are the disciples turning to Jesus and not looking out to check on the other people in the other boats? Are they keeping watch to see if anyone out there goes under? What's with their total self-focus here? There are so many questions we could ask. So where do your questions take you in the middle of this gale with gusting winds and water lapping over the side, Jesus snoozing in the middle of it all? Where do your questions take you in relation to fear? Now, Jesus, of course, responds to the whole event with yet another question. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" This could also be translated as, "Have you yet no faith?" The disciples are, after all, works in progress, aren't we all? And it is only here in this moment of eerie calm after the storm that Jesus asks about their fear. When they fear in the midst of the storm, he doesn't lecture them or challenge them. He doesn't say, "Why are you afraid then?" No, he offers calm in their immediate fear by speaking peace into the very wind and waves, But as the wind and waves settle to stillness, the disciples' spirits become unsettled in a very different way. The literal translation of their response is, they feared a great fear. As David Lowes reminds us, these words are interestingly the same words that describe the shepherd's response to the angel at Jesus' birth in Luke chapter 2. What we describe as awe is really an intensified fear. A stunning event that draws silence and stillness and wonder. It's as though we can imagine Jesus saying, "Of course you were afraid of dying out there in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, fellas, but you all are looking at me right now with a different kind of fear. A fear that recognizes I'm not just the teacher you woke up from a nap, but I'm the one who can calm storms with a word. And you are going with me to speak peace into chaos. But that means you have to get to the chaos first. You and I both know that the land we're about to dock on is unfamiliar and full of people who need healing, people who may not be so welcoming, but people who need to hear peace spoken anyway. We're about to go from point A to point B, and I have called you to come with me. And now in the middle of this sea, you are realizing more about who you have decided to learn from and follow, and it scares you. I see it. Now what are you going to do about it? Why are you afraid? Before we go into the land of the Gerasenes, before this next step out of the boat, you all need to do some soul searching and look internally and answer this question. Why are you afraid? Jesus doesn't promise that following him will keep us safe. Sometimes he calls people to get into boats and start across the waters, even though storms will come. The question we need to answer is, why are we afraid? And how is that fear keeping us from continuing to the other side where people are waiting for wholeness? Or how does that fear keep us from getting in the boat when our own wholeness is at stake? What do we need to come to terms with internally, each and every one of us, to be able to go with Jesus into the places that are yet unknown to us, but where Jesus wants us to go all the same? Am I even willing to step foot into the boat to begin with? Or am I still back in Capernaum asking whether or not the boat itself is safe? Jesus makes clear that he is trying to move us somewhere. He is trying to get the disciples to go from point A to point B. He didn't give them a few days to pack for this trip or prepare for it. This is on-the-job training on an unplanned business trip. He said to them, "Hey, here we are in Capernaum, and now let's get in this boat and cross the sea to get to the land of the Gerasenes." But remember, this is the place where Jesus will cast demons out of a man possessed into a herd of swine that will be driven by the demons into the water and drown. If the storm in the boat had them second guessing, imagine what the sales pitch for the next step in ministry might have done to them. Former president at Lutheran Seminary and pastor Reverend David Lowes says about this morning's text, quoting his sister, Reuben says, "People fear miracles because they fear being changed," which is the source, I think, of this other kind of fear that stands somewhere between a holy awe and a mighty terror, the fear of being changed. And make no mistake, Jesus is asking the disciples to change. In this very moment, he is drawing them from the familiar territory of Capernaum to the strange and foreign land of the Gerasenes, and he is moving them from being fishermen to disciples. And he is preparing them to welcome a kingdom so very different from the one they'd either expected or wanted. The change they are facing is real and hard and inevitable, and all of this becomes crystal clear as they realize the one who is asking them to change has mastery over the wind and the sea and is indeed the Holy One of God. That change, of course, will also and ultimately be transformative, but I doubt if they see that yet. Sometimes Jesus has a place in mind for us to go, and he doesn't always give us a whole lot of lead time. Frankly, we might rather make our packing list, order the necessary supplies after carefully comparing prices, and then try packing the supplies several different ways in the boat. Maybe we'd like time to discern whether we should step in with our left foot first or our right foot first. I'd like to hear stories from people who have been in the same model of boat and find out what they liked or what they wish they'd known before they went to the other side. And also, will I need to bring along anything to mend the nets so we'll have enough fish along the way, or did somebody else pack that? And then once we arrive, is there an Airbnb situation, or should we send another boat first to make sure we have somewhere to sleep when we arrive? And who on this boat has our itinerary? Does this sound familiar to anybody else in the room at all? Or maybe some of us are completely on the flip side as planners, absolutely ready to jump in that boat before we know what's up ahead, even if the whole waves in the boat disaster could have been avoided if someone had just checked the weather. Maybe you find yourself regularly in the middle of choppy waters, raging at Jesus for sleeping while you're in a mess you steered directly into, even if Jesus was the one who chose the itinerary. But you'll have a good story to tell once the fear subsides. Sound familiar to anyone else here? Some of us like to jump in and fear later. Some of us like to try and out-prep the fear. Most of us would rather live without fear altogether. And so we don't mind chastising Jesus for napping when we think he ought to be doing thus and so the way things are intended to happen, at least in our minds. But whether we fear before we hop in, tremble in the middle of the sea, or experience awe too terrifying to describe after God does the unthinkable, fear can be a mixed blessing, a hindrance, a barrier, and a whole lot in between. Fear moves us, and it motivates us. It keeps us from jumping in and from acting reasonably and rationally. And sometimes it shakes us so very deeply that all we know to do is stand there struck and stuck. Now, I don't know what you are afraid of. I don't know what would keep you from jumping in the boat in the first place, or what would make you yell at Jesus himself to wake up. I don't know what would haunt you were God to actually do the miraculous today. But I do know that God is trying to get you from point A to point B in some way, because God doesn't leave any of us at the starting line. So why are you currently afraid? In her book, Learning to Walk in the Dark, Barbara Brown Taylor writes, "After years of being taught that the way to deal with painful emotions is to get rid of them, it can take a lot of reschooling to learn to sit with them instead, finding out from those who feel them and what they have learned by sleeping in the wilderness that those who sleep in comfortable houses may never know." She goes on later saying, "I have learned things in the dark that I could never have learned in the light. Things that have saved my life over and over again, so that there is really only one logical conclusion. I need darkness as much as I need light." Jesus asks us to consider, why are we afraid? And what is the relationship currently of our fear and our faith? In the world of Monsters, Inc., the dark is necessary to be able to generate light on a more literal level. Electrical power is generated through making children cry out, and the sound is captured and turned into electricity. And it isn't until two scream-generating and scream-catching monsters accidentally encounter a child in their own world and on the child's terms that they come to realize that a child's touch won't actually kill them. And the truth that they discover, spoiler alert, is that her laughter, Her laughter, it turns out, will generate 10 times the power of her scream. Joy, it seems, can solve all of the monster world's power problems. When Sully and Mike realize that Boo's touch won't harm anyone, they try to tell the monster in charge of the power company, but it seems that he knew this all along. You see, if anyone found out that a child's touch was harmless, how could he justify having told everyone for so many years that it was not only okay, but the duty of every hardworking monster on the factory floor to keep children at an arm's length and to train daily to make them cry? When the truth will make him look like a monster, he'll do anything to keep it under wraps, even banishing Sully and Mike to the wintry land where the abominable snowman resides, hoping to get rid of them too for good, hoping to keep everyone else locked in fear. No one can know that a child's touch won't kill them. How could the monsters go on making children cry out in the night if the children were seen as lovable little human beings ready to hold hands and play games and snuggle at night? Recognizing the belovedness of one another sometimes comes at a cost. Yet choosing to demonize difference comes at a cost far greater, both in the world of Monsters, Inc. and in our own. We soon learn that the CEO of Monsters, Inc. has been working on creating a system to capture more power by stealing children from their homes and locking them into contraptions that will elicit their cries. If the company can keep everyone afraid of the children, power can still be generated by the worst possible means. Does this storyline sound familiar to you at all? Fear can keep us at a distance from each other in this world. It can keep us closed off, and sometimes, yes, fear can even keep us safe. But in each instance, we must ask ourselves, what is my relationship to fear here, in this moment, in this place? Is fear keeping me from even thinking about bailing out some of the water or looking beyond my own boat to see if anyone else out there has fallen into the waves? Is fear keeping me locked in place, frozen in the eerie calm after the storm, not sure what to do next? Is fear keeping me stuck in the middle of the sea, yelling at someone else, accusing them of not caring about the storm and all who are perishing? Is fear keeping me stuck somewhere between point A and the point B that Jesus is trying to get me to go? Theoretically ready to follow Jesus, but not yet ready to sign on for jarring miracles that I can't explain and going into places I've never been toward demon possessions and drowning swine. Until we understand the root of our own fear and until we really look at it, examine it, talk about it with each other, and share what we learn with those in power as many times as it takes, until we are really ready to examine the deep root of our fear, nothing will change. And maybe Reuben's sister was right. Maybe people fear miracles because they fear being changed. But I have hope that despite our fear, there is another way. I have hope even still because Jesus said to get in the boat. And maybe the first miracle is that the disciples got in. I have hope because Jesus tried to model resting up so that we can bear the brunt of the harshest waves. I have hope because Jesus speaks peace into the chaos of our terrified hearts in raging storms. And when we are frozen in fear, which causes us to wonder whether we have it in us to go the rest of the way to point B, where wholeness is needed, Jesus asks us to look inside and to wonder, why are we afraid? I have hope that with Jesus himself asking this question, that we will do the internal work to discover our own fear and discern the root of it so we can move through it and beyond it. I have hope that the cries of children in the night are not the only source of power. There is so much more energy to find in the laughter of children after all. By the end of the movie, all the monsters are training to make children laugh. That becomes their full vocation. Power is generated through creating relationships built on joy. Frederick Buechner once wrote, "Beneath our reputations, our pretension, beneath our religion or lack of it, we are all vulnerable, both to the storm without and the storm within." Point A to point B. Where is Jesus trying to move you? Why are you afraid? To God be the glory now and forevermore. Amen.